lobby and the military industrial complex. That's who the two major parties are beholden to. There's no real significant difference between the Republicans or the Democrats. And, you know, it's funny you mentioned the Iran deal. That's a perfect example.
The poll noted that for the fifth straight year, the percentage of Americans who think the U.S. should negotiate directly with adversaries has grown, now reaching 65%. Two-thirds of America supports the country's total withdrawal from Afghanistan. 40% of people declaring an opinion believe that the U.S. has not responded well to the unrest in Ukraine. The only foreign policy issue which gained as much support as diplomacy with Iran was that 80% of Americans demand more congressional oversight in the executive branch's ability to unilaterally declare wars. Ramin Mazahari, Chicago.
Afghan Muslims marked Islamic Unity Week and the birth anniversary of Prophet Muhammad, holding ceremonies in various cities. Here at Al-Zahra Mosque in Kabul, Muslims gathered to celebrate Islamic Brotherhood and the legacy of Prophet Muhammad. Religious scholars and participants said they are facing conspiracies and brutalities cooked and spied by arrogant powers and terrorist groups. They emphasized that Muslims can foil such plots through unity.
Uzbek, Hazara, Pashto and Tajik, we are all brothers and members of the Islamic Ummah. It is our responsibility to unite around Prophet Muhammad. We denounce any division between Islamic sects and countries. The Muslim world is the common land of Muslims, and we don't believe in colonial era borders. Therefore, we should help liberate Al-Quds. Al-Aqsa Mosque is the beating heart of Islam. Prophet Muhammad said that the protecting Quds is the same as protecting Mecca and Medina.
Jamea Afghanistan.
Recently, the Afghan society faced devastating plots and challenges, but we could overcome them through unity among Muslims. The enemies of Islam and arrogant powers plotted different conspiracies, including terrorist attacks, to sow sedition and pave the way for their interventions. We Muslim brothers are aware and united. Such evil plots and acts will lead to nowhere.
Likewise, the Al-Mustafa University in Kabul hosted a conference to discuss the character and morality of the Prophet of Islam. The event addressed the important role of Prophet Muhammad as a messenger of peace and kindness. Attendees here said Prophet Muhammad is their best role model ever. The Islamic Unity Week comes as Afghanistan this year faced waves of terror attacks, especially against Shia mosques and schools. Afghans say such attacks will only strengthen bonds of brotherhood between Muslims in the country. The Afghan nation has successfully symbolized Islamic solidarity in their society. They say no to discord in the face of enemies' plots. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
In the limelight.
The global transition from unipolar world order to a multipolar one has now become the gospel truth, with China ascending globally and Russia challenging the West forcefully. But how Muslims can secure a front row seat in this once-in-a-century transition? Leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, answered this strategic question in his recent speech before Muslim scholars participating in a pro-unity conference held by Iran. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned, please. Kayhan, international staff writer, wrote, when the leader of the Islamic Revolution calls the Islamic Republic of Iran is a mighty, unshakable tree, he is not exaggerating. As a matter of fact, he is speaking the undeniable truth, as the avowed enemies of the Iranian people very well know from their string of failures of the past 43 years, during which they have always ended up in a state of dizziness with badly bruised heads bleeding from the hits received from the twigs of the firmly rooted tree. The mighty, unshakable tree of the Islamic Republic, whose steadily growing branches ensure the security and welfare of the Iranian people, in addition to providing shade for the independent governments, movements, and people of the region, has foiled the American bids to invade, hatch coups, impose a war, murder scientists and senior military commanders, unleash the most macabrely murderous terrorists in such friendly countries as Syria, Iraq, and Afghanistan, illegally freeze assets, clamp economic sanctions, and instigate characterless men and women to indulge in scattered cases of urban terrorism. Washington is totally wrong in thinking the outcasts of the society with no roots in either Islamic faith or Iranian culture, and who cannot even be called humans in view of their desecration of sanctities, obscene sloganeering, and indecent attire, can axe at least a few branches of this giant tree. And there is another question here. How can a country nurtured by sacred blood of martyrs and flourishing on the faith and dedication of scores of millions of Iranian Muslim men and women active in all spheres of society be overrun and handed over to the minions of the US, Britain, France, and the fake regime of Israel? Revolution requires roots to triumph and continue its triumphant course, as the dedicated Iranian Muslim masses have constantly shown from 1978 till this date, helping the country achieve spectacular success in all fields, including medicine, modern science and technology. No wonder the leader of the Islamic Revolution, at the mention of whose name the US and its comrades in crimes shake in fear, has called the Islamic Republic of Iran a mighty, unshakable tree. Also, Tehran Times wrote this headline saying, "Unity key to sublime position in a changing world," the leader of the Islamic Revolution said. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei has explained how Muslims can secure a sublime position in a world in transition. The global transition from unipolar world order to a multipolar one has now become the gospel truth, with China ascending globally and Russia challenging the West forcefully. But how Muslims can secure a front row seat in this once-in-a-century transition? Ayatollah Khamenei answered this strategic question in his recent speech before Muslim scholars participating in a pro-unity conference held by Iran. The 36th International Islamic Unity Conference was held in Tehran, with Iranian President Ayatollah Sayyid Ebrahim Raisi as the key speaker. The participants of the conference, the heads of the three branches of government, including judiciary, executive, and legislative, and a group of government officials, met with Ayatollah Khamenei on the occasion of the birth anniversaries of Prophet Muhammad and Imam Sadiq. In his speech, The leader spoke about the character of Prophet Muhammad, saying, "The Holy Prophet's character is unique in the entire universe. His birthday is a very important, great day. Calling the birthday of the Prophet an Eid is not just for holding a celebration and commemorating him. It is also for learning from him and setting the Prophet as an example." He said, according to a readout of the speech put out by the website of Khamenei.ir. One of the lessons from Prophet Muhammad for the Islamic nation is the Prophet grieves for your suffering. Of course, this doesn't just refer to Muslims at the time of the Prophet. It means the sufferings of the Muslims in Palestine, Myanmar, etc. today grieve his pure soul. Ayatollah Khamenei then addressed the suffering of present-day Muslims and linked it to global imperialism. Global imperialism rejoices at the suffering of Muslims. Why are Muslim nations suffering like this? Why are the Muslims suffering economically, politically, and from aggression, colonialism, civil wars, etc.? One of the most important reasons is the division of Muslims, he said, adding, "The Muslim nation's current sufferings are due to their division. This is what happens when we are divided, not concerned about each other, and even hostile to each other at times. The Quran says, when you are divided, you will be humiliated. Thus, you will help others to dominate you." The leader of the Islamic Revolution also pointed to how the enemy sows division among Muslims. He said the enemy does not want to see Muslims united. Instead, it wants them disunited. Furthermore, the enemy planted Israel in the region to serve as a base for the West. According to the leader, the enemy wants the opposite of unity between Muslims today. They created a cancerous cell in the region, the Zionist regime, to serve as a base for Western enmity against Islam. They brought the murderous, brutal Zionists to oppressed Palestine, creating a fake government to do this. In this context, the leader addressed the trend of normalization between Israel and some Arab states. He said normalization with Israel is an act of treason. The enemies are working to do something so that the Zionist regime, this cancer cell, won't be called the enemy anymore. They wish to create more discord between the countries of the region. These normalizations are one of the biggest acts of treachery against Muslims, the leader said. Since 2020, some Arab states, namely Bahrain, Morocco, the United Arab Emirates, and Sudan, have moved to establish full diplomatic relations with the fake regime of Israel, despite warnings from Iran and discontent in Arab public opinion.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
This one lay. bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The UK government is in chaos. The Chancellor of the Exchequer was just sacked by the UK Prime Minister Liz Truss, replaced by Jeremy Hunt, the former Foreign Secretary, who somehow is now fit to be the Finance Minister. In this edition of The Spotlight, we'll look at how and what went so wrong for Prime Minister Liz Truss and her so-called mini-budget, with calls ringing louder for her resignation, and whether there's a lifeline for the UK economy or not. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Historian and journalist Tony Gosselin joins us from London. Also joining us is President of the European Institute for International Law, Mahmoud Rafat, who joins us from Stockholm.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Tony Gosselin, I'll first start with you. Basically, let's find out from you what is your explanation behind what is going on, especially when it comes to this mini budget, which is now turned out to be a real crisis for Liz Truss and her premiership.
Well, I think there's a certain degree of sabotage going on within the British economy. We had a whole month during September where there was a leadership contest between Rishi Sunak and Liz Truss, and the promise that Truss gave to all of those Conservative Party members was, "I will reduce your taxes." Well, of course, they just were thinking with their wallets and voted for her. The trouble is that actually there is nowhere that she could reduce taxes at all, really, because the markets have reacted in the way that the only way they could, which is to say, well, if you're going to reduce taxes, that means that the government borrowing, it cannot be paid back, and therefore we're going to have to, punish you and tell you that we want the government to be able to pay its debts, and that's what they've done. The markets have punished them. They've said if you're going to be cutting taxes, you're not going to be able to fulfil your budgetary needs in paying all these debts back. The fact is, the only place where at the moment where Truss and the government can actually get enough tax in is from the super rich, and these are the one group of people and the most powerful businesses. The businesses are very good at not paying tax, by the way, but the super rich, as they get paid income in Britain, they have, you know, it's very easy to take that tax off them, and she was going to cut that. So I mean, it was a disastrous policy from the start, just built on greed from the Conservative Party members voting for her. But as I said, I think there's an element of sabotage here. There are some powerful influences out there that do want to see economies crash. We've seen it in many other countries around the world. Okay. Argentina, I mean, the list goes on. And what happens is, as those economies start to crash, because most people think, well, you don't want that to happen, but some people do want that to happen, is they are then able to buy up all those assets for very little money and make an absolute fortune. We're talking about the people like George Soros, international dealers and traders that can make a fortune on a crash. This is the trouble, is the international markets, particularly those centred in the EU and in London, in the city, and in Wall Street are basically like a casino. And so games are played, and that's what's been happening. And Liz Truss has completely lost touch with reality. This Chancellor, what they were doing is they were trying to do things which just had no economic sense to them whatsoever. And so I think now Kwarteng has gone, Liz Truss is going to have to go very soon because she backed him all the way. And the Conservative Party is going to have to find a new leader.
Well, we're going to get to those topics, especially the one that you say that there's maybe sabotage going on. But Mahmoud Rafat, if you can tell us in layman terms, what was so wrong with this mini budget that caused such a crisis, which has put into question the credibility of Liz Truss and her administration as a whole?
Well, which is appearing for us is the taxes problem and the bad plan which was put by the government of Truss, and especially to apply the same taxes on rich and poor, which represents a big contradiction with the social justice and also with the logic. But let's say, or let me repeat, this is what is appearing. Prime Minister Truss carried the heritage of long history of bad politics and also big messy. Don't forget, the Brexit is one of elements we can say not endamaged, but somehow broke big part of the British economy. Let's say also the markets in UK are not stable at all because of the big potentiality of the independence of Scotland next year, which will be followed for sure by independence of North Ireland. There is lots of elements she carried them as a heritage, or this government carried them, but she did not work on solving one of these dark elements. On the contrary, her government put a catastrophic plan, especially economic plan. Also, the involvement in UK strongly in the Russian-Ukrainian war was supporting one side, not only economically or militarily, but strategically. That's putting the UK economy in the same package or the same pocket of the war. And when there are wars, we always see investors do not trust so much in such economy. There is big trust used to be in the French economy, which we no longer find today because of lots of elements she did not create, but she aggravated the situation by the tax cutting.
Well, let's get into what the Institute of Fiscal Studies has said here, Tony Gosling, because basically they pretty much hit the target when they talked about this mini budget. They called into question in terms of where the money was going to come from, and that was about £60 billion that the UK will need in spending cuts. It said that unfunded tax cuts need to create that money, but how will the UK economy be able to do that? Of course, we know in the books they have forecasted a certain percentage of growth. I think it was 2.5%, but they said at best 0.7 or 0.8% is how much the UK economy is going to grow. So that's a blatant piece of fact that's out there. How did Liz Truss and her former Exchequer plan to convince people of that, which at this point is
a
void now?
I don't think they thought it through at all. I think that they had basically taken a few lines from an advertising agency in order to get themselves into power, get themselves elected in the election campaign over the summer, but they hadn't actually thought about what the implications might be. Look, let me just spell out a couple of basics here, because there is this thing called quantitative easing or printing money that the Bank of England's been doing. It's been using that money that it's created to purchase government bonds this week. It's just decided yesterday it's going to stop doing that, apparently, which means on Monday when the market's open, God only knows what's going to happen. We could have all sorts of problems with pensions. House prices could tank, mortgage rates going up. You know, this is becoming much more expensive for ordinary people. What should really happen with the money the Bank of England are making it up is they should just gift it to people who are on benefits, people who are on low pay, people that can't afford to buy food or having to go to food banks. Give it to them. Give each one of those people who are having to claim government subsidies or Social Security or whatever £2,000, because you know what? They'll spend the money, and that will help all other elements of the economy. Because the way that they're spending this money at the moment is just going into the pockets of the people who have shares, and it's going in for asset purchases, and it's going to the rich, basically. So give that money, Bank of England, to the poor, and you'll see the economy start to pick up. So that's a really basic thing to understand. I mean, what we've had is, you're right, lots of instability. July, the Chancellor was Rishi Sunak. August, the Chancellor was Nadeem Zahawi. September, the Chancellor was Kwasi Kwarteng. And now in October, we've got another Chancellor, Jeremy Hunt. It gives the impression the Conservative Party haven't got a clue what they're doing.
Exactly.
And it's very unlikely that they will come up with policies now which will help the poorer people, which is the poor are the only ones who will actually manage to pick the economy up, I think, and get it moving again.
Well, you touched on a very important point there. And Mahmoud Rafat, just plain logic dictates when you have a position such as that, finance minister or the exchequer, have different people fill that position three times now, and you have the fourth person come into the picture, Hunt, who has varied jobs in the past that don't exactly constitute to him being an expert on finances in a country, I'm guessing. Just a sign of disarray. And then furthermore, a certain amount of time has passed in a very crucial period of time you're rocked by so many different economic factors. How can, after all these people to have come and gone, for there to be a promise of stability in the economic life of Britain, so to speak?
Well, let's say it's not questions only of experts. Always the economy is a follower to politics, and policies impact the economy and the functioning of the economy in any country over the world, whatever to be the degree of democracy of this country or this nation. The question is, and matters not left completely to experts' opinions. No, the politicians and decision makers who are not experts financially intervenes in lots of matters, and also their policies they put damage lots of plans put by experts, and this is which explains also the bad politics, especially last decades, especially last one decade, and the policies were adopted by politicians in UK were completely in lots of situations wrong politics and wrong policies, which led today to this heritage I was talking about a few minutes ago. Madame Truss has carried when she entered Downing Street. While, again, the question is not only one reason. We have lots of reasons. United Kingdom has been accumulating lots of reasons to drop down today. It's not something happened last week or last month. It's bad policies, bad interventions in some areas of the world.
How far back would you go with that?
Well, let's just have a look what happened in the Middle East last decade and the UK intervention in last decade. UK did not intervene rationally as all as its history, comparing to its history of intervention. Its old colonial empireship should have big experience how to intervene and how to act when there are conflicts, while we found the UK intervening completely wrongly since 2003, even before that, since the Iraq War.
I just want to get an idea about the time frame that you were talking about. I'm sorry to jump in because I want to now ask that question from you, Tony Gosselin. Our guest there talked about a decade, but then he went back all the way to 2003. Tell us if you think that this is something that's either been in the making for quite some time or something that the UK maybe never really recovered from based on the 2008 financial crisis. If you want to take a look at the origins of, wrong policies or what have you.
Well, I can be absolutely precise and say, really, the origin of this is 1976. That is the removal of Harold Wilson, who was the Prime Minister, by the army in Britain and the far right and the right-wing army in Britain. They kicked him out of office and replaced him with James Callaghan. Anyone that doesn't know about this, there are some very good books on it. The Enemy Within, I think, is one of them. And the Wilson Plot is another one. Very interesting the way he was got, because he was managing the economy for the Labour Party, for the British people. And ever since then, we've had then, of course, the Thatcher era began in the 1980s. And that, I think, is actually the start of finance capitalism getting a grip on Britain. That is to say, everything is privatised bit by bit. I mean, Thatcher, it was like every 2 or 3 months, another major state-owned industry was sold off to the international markets. And that meant that anybody in the world with a lot of money could just buy up British infrastructure. This was a beginning of the end, in a way, and what they called at the time Thatcher selling off the family silver. So now finance capitalism, whatever it is, 40 years later, has become absolutely king. Finance capitalism dictates the policies to prime ministers at Chequers at their private residence. Finance capitalism dictates which broadcasters are owned by who. And so the two main organs that the public have got to defend them from voracious, rich, acquisitive people, that is to say, a democratic parliament, right, and the press, are both taken over by finance capitalists. And that's happened with the opposition Labour Party too here in the UK, where we've got a so-called opposition party which doesn't even support ordinary workers around the country, as we're getting lots of strikes starting in Britain now, even keep with their wages, keeping pace with inflation. Now, if the Labour Party can't even support that, they're clearly working, just as the Conservatives are, for the finance capitalists, for the City of London. And what we really need is a mixed economy where we have a government that asserts its strength, controls its infrastructure, and makes sure the poorest and the most or the least well-off in the country are looked after, as well as the super-rich. This government, and actually the opposition Labour Party, really only care about the super-rich that pay their wages for their political parties now.
I'm going to get back to that point, see if I can add something to that to challenge you. But, okay, we got about 5 minutes left, max. Mahmoud Rafat, so here we are, and here is the UK, and here is what they're dealing with. How are they going to move forward? What do they have in mind in terms of what anything that points towards some kind of recovery from what's happened? I mean, you have Jeremy Hunt that has come forward, and he has again made a U-turn. I lost count on how many U-turns have been made from the beginning of this. Two were cited. I think I counted five based on what Jeremy Hunt has also said. But how can the UK move forward based on your analysis to come out of this situation and for there to be some stability there?
Well, I don't think there is a magic solution. It's not a bottom we will hit. We will find solution for the economy and we will get back the economic stability and the purchase power will get back affordable by society. I don't think that will happen in the close future. In particular, I'm repeating again, the question of the referendum of Scotland, it will be a big and huge earthquake if the Supreme Court of the UK accepted the case and Scottish went to referendum, the big chance is to vote yes. And that will represent earthquake, not only for the economy, by the way, but on the whole life of the United Kingdom. But, well, simply, this nation will not exist anymore. The United Kingdom will not be the United Kingdom anymore, or the Great Britain anymore. It will be England. So there is no quick solution. There are some suggestions to be adopted on a very long term. When I say long term, it's not one decade. It's around between 2 to 5 years in order to get some stability. But that will not be, we will never be able to start on that until the decision of the Supreme Court concerning Scotland, and if yes, to see the vote results and what will happen after this result to start from there, from 2023, when the shape of the relationship between Scotland and UK has been appeared, at that time, we will be able to start some procedures and to give the case and the files really to the experts without interventions of politicians.
Well, you have to have a stable government to do that. And you talked about the Labour Party there. and you, Tony Gosling, and you talked about how there should be a mixed, I forgot the term that you used.
Mixed economy.
But the Labour Party says that the Tories have lost the right to govern. And they're saying that the Conservative Party is just going to try to cling to power. And if it does that, it's going to bring down the country with it. What other options does UK have then?
Well, look, do you want Tony Blair back? I mean, because Starmer is even more extreme than Tony Blair. So he also has lost the right to govern. No, I think there are some very simple, quick solutions, but these are actually taboo. But the simple, quick solution, number one, is what I said before, is the people's quantitative easing. That is to say, printing money and giving it to the poor in order to kickstart the economy, you know, maybe even give £10,000 to everybody with no savings. A very simple thing that they could be doing, and that would be a fraction of the money that the Bank of England have been giving to the rich over the last, well, isn't it now 15 years, is it nearly, that they've been, well, no, not quite, but a long time anyway. So the people's QE, give that to poor people. The other thing they can do is they can regulate the privatised industries, all of the infrastructure, the railways, the electricity, the water, the gas. They can just restrict that, and they can renationalise it for free. And once the government is able to set the prices properly so that the there's no racketeering going on in the infrastructure, everybody will be able to get on and make some money. So there's two very basic things. Another one, of course, is the bankers that were responsible for what we call the banksters for the financial crisis.
Sure.
The criminal bankers, they must be arrested and put in jail. I think those three measures would make a tremendous amount of difference and put the British economy back on track again.
With that, we come to an end, unfortunately, of this edition of The Spotlight. I'd like to thank Tony Gosling, historian and journalist, and also like to thank Mahmoud Rafat, president of the European Institute for International Law. That does it for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Vitagwe and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
In the limelight. The number of suicides among American veterans has increased in the past decade to the extent that the number is higher than the total number of American soldiers killed in the wars in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Vietnam. Publication of news and events related to troubles and problems as well as suicide of American veterans is censored by the media affiliated with the U.S. Republicans and Democrats. Today, the majority of veterans who have been engaged in looting, occupying and killing innocent people in Afghanistan and Iraq admit that their presence and participation in the bloody game of the White House and the Pentagon only led to the regression in their personal and social lives. We have taken a look at some of the world media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us for more. The website of NBC News has more on this story. A new study found more military veterans died by suicide than the Department of Veteran Affairs had previously reported. According to a study released on Saturday, 17th of September, by America's Warrior Partnership, a national non-profit organization that works to end veteran suicide, the number of suicide among former service members is 1.37 times greater in 8 states than the Department of Veteran Affairs had reported from 2014 to 2018. The report found if those states represent a national rate, that would mean about 24 veterans die by suicide each day, compared with the Department of Veteran Affairs' average of 17.7 suicides in that time frame. Jim Lorraine, America's Warrior Partnership president, who served in the Air Force for 22 years, said, "It's devastating. I'm not only a veteran myself, My son serves, my son-in-law serves as well. My wife is a veteran. I know a lot of veterans who have died from suicide. The report examined data from Alabama, Florida, Maine, Massachusetts, Michigan, Minnesota, Montana, and Oregon. America's Warrior Partnership, or AWP, said those eight states, which represent 18% of all U.S. veterans, were the only states to provide usable data, adding that most states had been barred from releasing data because of confidentiality restrictions. The report found veterans who served less than 3 years were at the greatest risk of suicide, and the odds of dying by suicide increased by 56% if the veteran had received a demotion. The report said former members of the Coast Guard were most likely to die by suicide, followed by Marine Corps, the Army, Navy, and Air Force service members. The website of Global News explains more about the same story. A comprehensive new study has revealed that American military veterans are committing suicide at a much higher rate than the U.S. government is reporting. According to the new study, an average of 24 former service members are taking their own lives every day, 37% more than what has been reported by the U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs. In addition, 20 veterans on average are dying each day by self-injury mortality, such as drug overdose. According to the new study, the official figures are lower because of undercounting related to drug overdose deaths and service record errors, which reviewed census death data from 2014 to 2018 for 8 states. It found thousands of cases of suspected or confirmed suicides that were not included in federal reports. Jim Lorraine, a U.S. Air Force veteran, said, "These are all preventable deaths. The number is less important than the methodology of tracking them and making sure we have an accurate count that can lead us to prevention steps." Jim Lorraine said many drug-related deaths in the states that researchers reviewed were classified as accidents or undermined, even though there were indications that they should have been tagged as suicide. There were also cases where the military history of the deceased individuals was incorrectly reported, resulting to a further undercounting of the number of veteran suicides. Suicide has been described as a national health crisis in the United States, with more than 45,000 Americans taking their own lives each year. Also, suicide rates among active duty U.S. military members are currently at an all-time high since record-keeping began after 9/11 and have been increasing over the past 5 years at an alarmingly steady pace. In fact, some branches of the U.S. Armed Forces are experiencing the highest rate of suicide since the Second World War. In 2021, research found that 30,177 active duty personnel and veterans who served in the military after 9/11 have died by suicide, compared to 7,057 service members killed in combat in those same 20 years. That is, military suicide rates are 4 times higher than deaths that occurred during military operations. The AmericanAddictionCenters.org website has more on the same story. A major yet preventable health problem in the United States is suicide. Sadly, veterans comprise nearly a quarter of all suicide deaths in the United States. In 2017, a team of researchers looking at data on more than 4.8 million veterans found that veterans with substance use disorders had twice the risk of suicide compared to those without a substance use disorder. Other commonly cited factors leading to increased suicide risk in veterans, as well as other groups, were anger, rage, mood swings, and episodes of anxiety and agitation, expressing feelings of having no reason to live, increased alcohol abuse and/or substance abuse, self-destructive and risky behaviors like driving while impaired. The suicide rate for veterans is 1.5 times higher than that of the general population. Comparing the rate among female veterans to non-veteran adult women, the rate is 2.5 times higher. From 2001 to 2014, the U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs reports an increased suicide rate among women using Department of Veteran Affairs services from 14.4 per 100,000 to 17.3 per 100,000 of the population. Suicide rates are especially high among older veterans. According to the Department of Veteran Affairs, in 2016, about 58% of all veterans committed suicide were among veterans aged 55 years or older. Several other factors, in addition to distance, play a role in higher suicide rates among older veterans. Certain emotional precursors may precede suicide events, including feelings of loneliness, isolation, hopelessness, and depression.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Virtues of the Believers, Friday the 3rd of Ramadan, 1394, the 20th of September, 1974. Tawakkul means that in every situation you rely on Allah and place your hopes in Him. Have you seen how when some people face difficulties in life, when they go through hardship and they exhaust every visible means at their disposal to rectify their situation without success, what do they do? Have you seen or heard this? They will do one of a few things. Either they will surrender, when nothing they do seems to work, or they will resign themselves to fate, or they will take the path of least resistance. They won't give up, but in practice they will do whatever is easiest. Others end their own lives. For example, someone gains power in a country, and little by little, other powers wear him down. Every day, somewhere in his dominion, there is some clamor against him. Then when he has no choices left, when he is utterly humiliated, tired and dejected, he takes his own life, he ends it. These are the routes open to someone when they don't have Allah and find themselves in a blind alley. When they reach a dead end and they see that they have nowhere left to turn, no escape, these people will take one of three options. They will either surrender to fate, take the path of least resistance, or they will kill themselves. However, for someone who believes in Allah and find themselves at a dead end, these options are not available to them. Their dignity won't let them follow these paths. But there is one door that is always open to them. And what door is that? Placing their trust in Allah. They will say, "This is a dead end, but the Allah I know makes doors out of dead ends." What is a dead end? For Allah, there are no dead ends for us. In Allah's hands, every dead end is a door. There is always a way.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Is there a dead end worse than the Battle of Uhud? The few soldiers of Islam, preoccupied with the pursuit of spoils on the battlefield, forgot to guard the flanks. Because of the heedlessness of a few soldiers, the Quraysh were able to outflank the Muslims, who had laid down their swords and dismounted their horses to collect spoils. Suddenly, they see themselves surrounded by the enemy on all sides, attacking them. Now, it's clear what an unarmed, unprepared soldier will do in this situation, isn't it? He runs. He runs for his life. Shaitan calls out through the voice of a wicked person that the Prophet has been slain. It's obvious, Shaitan is always doing this. Shaitan's plans are clear and his helpers are clear. He is always putting doubts in people's minds. He is always sapping their morale, telling them they failed, that the Prophet has died. In this crisis, in this dead end, what does a faithful person who relies on Allah do? Is there a dead end greater than this? There is no way out. Your own soldiers have thrown down their weapons and fled. The enemies have surrounded you on all sides. No one is coming to your aid. But there is still a way out, to put your trust in Allah, to have hope.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.